Chapter 10. When Dorothy Kilgallen learned that JFK and her friend Marilyn Monroe were having an affair, she did not hesitate to print the truth. And so, on August 3, 1962, 2 months before the Cuban Missile Crisis, and within 3+ years of her death, she became the first journalist to reveal Marilyn's relationship with a Kennedy by writing, "Marilyn Monroe's health must be improving. She's been attending select Hollywood parties and has become the talk of the town again. In California, they're circulating a photograph of her that certainly isn't as bare as the famous calendar, but is very interesting. And she's cooking in the sex appeal department, too. She's proved vastly alluring to a handsome gentleman who is a bigger name than Joe DiMaggio in his heyday. So don't write off Marilyn as finished."
Even someone on Mars would have realized who Kilgallen was referring to as a bigger name than Joe DiMaggio in his heyday, especially after Marilyn had shocked the world with her steamy rendition of Happy Birthday to JFK.
But Kilgallen had little time to consider a reaction to the article, since just 2 days later, Marilyn was found dead in her Brentwood, California hacienda. Right away, as would be the case when JFK and Lee Harvey Oswald were assassinated, Kilgallen had more questions than answers about the investigation. She wrote, "If the woman described as Marilyn's housekeeper, Eunice Murray, is really a housekeeper, why was Marilyn's bedroom such a mess? It was a small house and should have been easy to keep tidy." Kilgallen also wondered, "Why was Marilyn's door locked that night, when she didn't usually lock it? If she was just trying to get to sleep and took the overdose of pills accidentally, why was the light on? Usually people sleep better in the dark." Adding to her suspicions, Kilgallen asked, "Why did the first doctor arriving on the scene have to call the second doctor before calling the police? Any doctor, even a psychiatrist, knows a dead person when he sees one, especially when rigor mortis has set in and there are marks of lividity on the surface of the face and body. Why the consultation? Why the big-time gap in such a small town? Mrs. Murray gets worried at about 3 a.m., and it's almost 6 a.m. before the police get to the scene." Continuing to question facts surrounding the Hollywood legend's death, Kilgallen closed the column with the statement, "The real story hasn't been told, not by a long shot." In a tribute column to Marilyn, Kilgallen wrote, "Sleep well, sweet girl. You have left more of a legacy than most. If all you ever left was a handful of photographs of one of the loveliest women who ever walked the face of the earth." As Kilgallen continued to be deeply affected by Marilyn's death, she discovered Marilyn had been speaking with someone from D.C. right before she died, having been provided details of Marilyn and Robert Kennedy's love affair by a photographer friend of Marilyn. She believed it was RFK who she had called, or that Marilyn had called him. In October 2017, an FBI memo dated July 7, 1964, released with additional JFK assassination files by the government, confirmed what Kilgallen knew, through her sources, that RFK had picked up where JFK left off when he dumped the famous movie star. It read, "Memo, Baumgartner to Sullivan, July 7, 1964, stated New York office advised that new book by Frank A. Capel, entitled The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe, which alleges that Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy had an intimate relationship with Miss Monroe, would be ready for sale about July 10, 1964. Kennedy's friendship with Miss Monroe, well known. The New York office has now furnished us with a copy of this 70-page book. The book claims that Miss Monroe's involvement with Kennedy was well known to her friends and reporters in the Hollywood area, but was never publicized. It is alleged that there are person-to-person telephone calls living witnesses, tape recordings, and certain writings to attest the closeness of their friendship. The author suggests that Miss Monroe was led to believe his intentions were serious, and that Kennedy had promised to divorce his wife and marry her. When he failed to do so, the book charges, she threatened to expose their relationship, which would have ruined his presidential aspirations. It was then that Kennedy decided to take drastic action. To date, no investigation on Kilgallen's part regarding her friend Marilyn's murder has surfaced. But there is little doubt the revered reporter connected both Kennedys to Marilyn's death. Ironically, in the years to come, many would attempt to connect Marilyn's demise with Kilgallen's 3 years later. Little doubt exists Kilgallen had a real fascination, as Marilyn Monroe did, with the belief that UFOs, unidentified flying objects, were more fact than fiction. In fact, the two celebrities' obsession with UFOs is connected to JFK's assassination. Unfortunately, speculation runs rampant with these theories. But what may be substantiated is that a 1962 CIA document exists featuring the contents of a wiretapped conversation between Marilyn and Kilgallen 2 days before Monroe died. During the call, Marilyn told Kilgallen that JFK had told Marilyn of his visit to a secret airbase where he viewed things from outer space. This admission allegedly involved the 1947 Roswell, New Mexico crash of what government officials swore was an Army Air Force balloon. Later, it was alleged that in fact an alien spacecraft had crash-landed, permitting a group of extraterrestrials to infiltrate the area with the government covering up the incident. During a press briefing that was supposed to be off the record, JFK was supposedly asked what he thought about UFOs. He became very serious and replied, "I would like to tell the public about the UFO situation, but my hands are tied." Some theories have circulated that the president was assassinated by those who feared his disclosure of further information about the UFO phenomenon. In fact, he had requested, according to a letter released by the CIA, more information on UFOs on November 12, 1963, days before his assassination. The subject line read, "Classification review of all UFO intelligence affecting national security." Top secret, November 12, 1963. Memorandum for the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Subject, "Classification review of all UFO intelligence files affecting national security. As I had discussed with you previously, I have initiated and have instructed James Webb to develop a program with the Soviet Union in joint space and lunar exploration. It would be very helpful if you would have the high threat cases reviewed with the purpose of identification of bona fide, as opposed to classified, CIA and USAF sources. It is important that we make a clear distinction between the knowns and unknowns in the event the Soviets try to mistake our extended cooperation as a cover for intelligence gathering of their defense and space programs. When this data has been sorted out, I would like you to arrange a program of data sharing with NASA, where unknowns are a factor. This will help NASA mission directors in their defensive responsibilities. I would like an interim report on the data review no later than February 1, 1964. John F. Kennedy. While the alleged conversation between Marilyn and Kilgallen is subject to conjecture, and JFK's participation in any investigation of UFOs open to questions, Kilgallen's own writings substantiate her interest in the subject. In February 1954, she had written, "Flying saucers are regarded as of such vital importance that they will be the subject of a special hush-hush meeting of the world military heads next summer. 1 year later, in the May 23, 1955 edition of the Los Angeles Examiner and other major newspapers under the banner By Dorothy Kilgallen, distributed by International News Service, she wrote, "I can report today on a story which is positively spooky, not to mention chilling." Followed by London, May 22nd. British scientists and airmen, after examining the wreckage of a mysterious flying ship, are convinced that these strange aerial objects are not optical illusions or Soviet inventions, but actually are flying saucers, which originate on another planet. The source of my information is a British official of cabinet rank who prefers to remain unidentified. We believe, on the basis of our inquiries thus far, that the saucers were staffed by small men, probably under 4 feet tall, my informant told me today. It's frightening, but there is no denying the flying saucers come from another planet. This official quoted scientists as saying a flying ship of this type could not have been constructed on Earth. The British government, I learned, is withholding an official report on the flying saucer examination at this time, possibly because it does not wish to frighten the public. When my husband, Richard Colmar, and I arrived here for a brief vacation, I had no premonition that I would be catapulting myself into the controversy over whether flying saucers are real or imaginary. In the United States, all kinds of explanations have been advanced, but no responsible official of the U.S. Air Force has yet intimated the mysterious flying ships had actually vaulted from outer space. On a daily basis, Kilgallen wrote her Voice of Broadway columns, hitting on as many subjects as possible. One column mentioned an author who would play an eerie part in her perplexing death a few years later. She wrote, "Novelist Robert Rourke, author of The Honey Badger, and his wife were conferring with their lawyers preliminary to an amicable divorce. The decree will be sought in Mexico." He was the same Robert Rourke, she knew, who had written a scathing article entitled "Sinatra is Playing with the Strangest People These Days," chastising the singer for hanging out in Havana in 1947 with gangsters like Lucky Luciano, Carlos Marcello, Frank Costello, and Santo Traficante, whom Rourke called scum. Meanwhile, Kilgallen, expanding her coverage of high-profile cases around the world, flew to England in July 1963 to cover the explosive trial of Dr. Stephen Ward. He was an English osteopath. One patient was Winston Churchill, and a central figure in the Profumo affair, a British political scandal triggering the resignation of John Profumo, the Secretary of State for War. The scandal contributed to the defeat of the Conservative government 1 year later, and Ward, before a verdict was announced in his trial, committed suicide by ingesting an overdose of sleeping pills. Displaying her prowess for prophetic prose, part of Kilgallen's Journal American column read, "There was a dinner party where a naked man wearing a mask waited on tables like a slave. The authorities, searching the apartment of one of the principals in the case, came upon a photograph showing a key figure disporting with a bevy of ladies. All were nude except for the gentleman in the picture, who was wearing an apron. And this was a man who had been on extremely friendly terms with the very proper queen and members of her immediate family." Following the Ward case, in September, the Journal American announced President Kennedy would visit Dallas for a campaign stop in November. She barely noticed, since Kilgallen faced a libel case in court filed by Elaine Shepard, a Broadway and motion picture actress, demanding $750,000 in damages for defamation of character. In the end, no damages were awarded by the jury in a case heard before Judge Thomas Aurelio. Years earlier, the judge had faced disbarment charges due to his friendship with New York gangster Frank Costello. A wiretap exposed the true extent of the friendship, one pointing to the mobster's ability to put judicial robes on obliging candidates. After Aurelio told Costello, "Thanks for everything," Costello said, "When I tell you something is in the bag or fixed, you could rest assured." Aurelio replied, "I want to assure you of my loyalty for all you have done for me. It is undying." Kilgallen never wrote about that case. However, she clearly knew that underworld figures, through bribes and influence, controlled many of the New York City politicians, judges, and police, with speculation that corruption had seeped into several administrative agencies, including the NYC Medical Examiner's Office. Earning large amounts of money was never the chief motivation for Dorothy Kilgallen's quest to become the best at the multiple professions she attempted. Instead, it is apparent she intended to live her life to the fullest, experiencing all she could in line with the statement she had made, as noted at an early age, "I'm a reporter who likes danger and excitement." In addition, being from humble beginnings, the college dropout wanted to show the world that she had worked hard and succeeded only because she never gave up and never gave in, professionally or personally. Overcoming one obstacle after another, Kilgallen epitomized what William Randolph Hearst Jr. once said. Dorothy had three trademarks: a keen mind, a tailored exterior, and a steel rod as a backbone. She was life and death. She reached into the precipices of people's emotions in both her writings and her personal confrontations with her own existence. She was enthusiastic, open, full of life. Kilgallen's success as a nationally known newspaper columnist, television star, and renowned investigative reporter made her rich by 1963 standards. Through various media ventures, her income was estimated at $200,000 a year, $1.5 million today, a mind-boggling figure for a woman during that time, reinforcing Kilgallen's position as a true media magnate without challenge. No doubt exists that if Time magazine had published a list of the highest-paid women in the United States, Kilgallen would have been near the top, if not at the very top. Meanwhile, Richard was still searching for success with various business ventures to provide him more self-esteem and show his wife he could attain success now that his Broadway producing efforts were over. These efforts did not produce income, and he had fallen into depression due to his failures and alcoholism. This meant Kilgallen was the family's sole breadwinner. Mark Sinclair called Richard Mr. Kilgallen. This label may have been a bit unfair. Competing with his celebrity wife and her ever-widening shadow had always been difficult for Richard. Richard's downfall was shocking, in lieu of the success he had enjoyed just 6 or 7 years earlier, when he'd appeared with Kilgallen on Person to Person with Edward R. Murrow. If one watches that interview, it is clear that Richard was full of bluster, proudly talking about his production of the hit show Plain and Fancy. Now, years later, he was a shadow of his former self, consumed with depression and a bona fide alcoholic. Perhaps it was a friendship with a fellow drinker that led Richard downhill. While describing a party at the townhouse where Carrie, then just a youngster, enjoyed bantering with a very drunken Jane Mansfield, Carrie recalled, "People began arriving around 6:30 p.m., early for a party, but it was the usual insiders. Bob Lynch, my father's best friend and a raging alcoholic, was the first to arrive. It was as if Bob thought that, despite having all the money in the world, we might just possibly be running out of scotch by 7 o'clock. Early arrival guaranteed him enough booze." Ever attentive to national matters, despite her marital woes, Kilgallen kept up with JFK's planned trip to Dallas. Little did she know that as September 1963 welcomed fall temperatures,
President Kennedy and his brother Bobby, the Attorney General, discussed the visit. JFK was hesitant to visit Texas, but RFK convinced his brother of the importance of appearing with Vice President Lyndon Johnson, concerned as he was that the president might erase him from the 1964 ticket. To assure LBJ that the administration had no such intentions, the Texas trip, Bobby assured JFK, was quite necessary. While Dallas made plans to welcome the president during the late summer months, Kilgallen and Richard quarreled over her public display of affection for Johnny Ray. Finally, Richard had had enough and forbade her to see him. Kilgallen was heartbroken. Disobeying her husband's orders, she continued the affair. As the days passed, Kilgallen's Journal American front page noted JFK's Dallas appearance. One time zone to the west, the Dallas Morning News posted the headline, "Storm of Political Controversy Swirls Around Kennedy on Visit." Despite this dim view of the visit, happy times prevailed among the thousands who lined the streets, seeking a glimpse of the charismatic president. As he and Jackie left the airport, smiles on their faces abounded, each unaware of the tragedy approaching. Kilgallen, watching television in the townhouse while she made notes for her Random House book, winced when NBC broke into normal programming with the announcement, "There will be a hotline bulletin in 10 seconds. It was followed by a commentator stating, "Several shots were fired as President Kennedy's motorcade passed through downtown Dallas." Later, she would hear that when Texas Governor John Connally, seated in front of JFK, heard the gunfire, he shouted, "My God, they're going to kill us all!" As details filtered in that JFK had been shot, tears began to roll down Kilgallen's cheeks as she realized the unfolding tragedy. Less than a 4-hour drive away from Kilgallen's townhouse, at Robert Kennedy's Hickory Hill home in McLean, Virginia, RFK, the second most powerful man in America, the one dubbed by White House associates assistant president, was discussing with two of his aides, including his rackets division investigator, ongoing Justice Department cases. These included cases against various mobsters, such as notoriously violent New Orleans Don Carlos Marcello, who was awaiting a jury verdict in a racketeering case. While munching on a tuna sandwich, RFK received a telephone call from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. He told Bobby about the assassination attempt. A few minutes later, Hoover called again. In an unsympathetic tone, he informed Bobby that JFK was dead. A distraught Kilgallen watched as CBS's Walter Cronkite delivered sad news to the nation. The president died at 1 p.m. Dallas time, 2 p.m. Eastern time. Continuing to monitor the television coverage, Kilgallen soon learned of the arrest of Lee Harvey Oswald in connection with the assassination. At police headquarters after his arrest, police told the handcuffed Oswald he could cover his face with his hands if he wished to do so. To that suggestion, Kilgallen watched with interest as he told reporters, "Why should I hide my face? I haven't done anything to be ashamed of." Still in shock over the death of her friend, Kilgallen watched as LBJ took the oath of office on Air Force One. He became the 36th President of the United States. Beside him stood Jackie Kennedy, blood still visible on her pink Chanel suit. Kilgallen paced the floor and began chatting with friends on the telephone. Meanwhile, at 4:45 p.m. EST at his Virginia home, a distraught RFK told his press secretary, Ed Guthman, "There's so much bitterness. I thought they would get one of us, but Jack, after all he had been through, I never worried about it. I never thought it would happen. I thought it would be me. There's been so much bitterness and hatred." Attempting to gain more information about what had happened, Kilgallen called contacts in Dallas and Washington, D.C. Her investigative reporter instincts on high alert, she began to question why JFK was killed.
Despite the late hour on the East Coast, Kilgallen watched the midnight press conference with Oswald in Dallas. The media gathered to learn more facts about JFK's assassin. He had stated, "I didn't kill the president. I didn't kill nobody." As the news conference commenced, 50-year-old District Attorney Henry Wade, his swept-back, thinning black hair streaked with silver, said Oswald was a member of the Anti-Castro Free Cuba Committee. Seconds later, someone in the back of the room shouted, "Henry, that's fair play for Cuba Committee." He turned out to be Jack Ruby, owner of the Carousel Strip Club in Dallas. Later, his co-counsel Joe Tonahill stated that Ruby was holding a stenographer's pad, making like a reporter. When the sun rose the next morning, Kilgallen held young Carrie in her arms, and they wept over JFK's death. In her column, Kilgallen recalled the visit with her son to the White House. She wrote, "The picture that stays in my mind is the one of this tall, young man bending over a small boy, carefully scrutinizing envelopes until he came to the name Kerry Arden Colmar, grade 3B. This is the man who was assassinated in Dallas."